The Sunstone Theological Society presents There Is No Space in Which There Is No Kingdom, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We can have your attention. My name is Sherry Hughes, and on behalf of Sunstone, I'd like to welcome you to this session today. The title of the session is There Is No Space in Which There Is No Kingdom, a study of Latter-day Saint cosmology. This is a paper by David Cameron, who is currently a PhD candidate with the Center for Religious Studies at the University of Toronto. Dave also has his BA from Brigham Young University in history and a Master of Theological Studies from Harvard. He's had a varied background. In addition to his interests in theology and science, he's written a short story that was published in Exponent 2, and he has some further journalistic background in that he was once an editorial intern at BYU Studies and worked briefly for the Seventh East Press. So he has a varied background, and I think that what we're going to hear from him today will be exciting. Responding to Dave's paper will be Professor Kent Nielsen from BYU. He's a professor of philosophy, and his specialty is the history of science and science and religion. His wife told me that he'd been at the Y forever. She couldn't count the years. It'd been too long. His degrees are in physics from Harvard, and he's married to Patricia, who teaches music at BYU. And between the two of them, they've got seven children. Dave told me that his paper that he's going to present today is more or less a dress rehearsal for his dissertation. So I think that we're all going to get a lot out of this. We will have him present it, and then Professor Nielsen will present his comments, and then we'll open it up to you for questions for the last few minutes. Thank you.
Just a note of clarification to begin with. I was sorry to see that the subtitle wasn't printed in the program, just this obscure verse from the Doctrine and Covenants. The subtitle, as Sherry said, was initially a study in Latter-day Saint cosmology, but I was toying with the idea of changing that to an excursion in Latter-day Saint cosmology, because in places our approach is somewhat more reflective or meditative, perhaps more excursive than studious. I don't know, you can judge for yourself. To begin, one of the most unsettling ideas among the many that are inflicted on us is the concept of the emptiness of existence. Considering the vastness of the open sky and the stretches of outer space which lie beyond and between the planets, the feeling of being disoriented, or at very least alone, in a cosmic vacuum is understandable. Blaise Pascal once wrote, "The eternal silence of these infinite spaces frightens me," while Nietzsche distilled the same sentiment by asking, "Are we not wandering through an infinite nothingness? Do we not feel the breath of empty space?" In contrast, Latter-day Saint cosmology has always been underscored with the idea of the omnipresence and immanence of God. Brigham Young taught that we believe God is round about all things, above all things, in all things, and through all things. To tell about empty space is to tell of a space where God is not. There is not such a thing as empty space. The concept finds a somewhat more poetic expression in the Doctrine and Covenants. "And there are many kingdoms, for there is no space in the which there is no kingdom, and there is no kingdom in the which there is no space, either a greater or a lesser kingdom." Interestingly, the concept of a divine presence or principle which pervades, animates, and organizes all existence has long been present in the history of ideas. Thales, who is often regarded as the first systematic philosopher on record in Western thought, apparently made this concept central to his teachings. Little is known about Thales' life, although he appears to have been the original absent-minded professor, since Plato tells that Thales once fell into a well while watching the stars, declaring that he was eager to know the things in the sky, but what was behind him and just by his feet escaped his notice. But he is most known for saying that all things are full of gods, reflecting the idea that there is a soul or mind or power that is intermingled in the universe. This material principle he perceived to be water, since moisture appeared to be essential to the sustenance of all life. Now, water is traditionally recognized as a powerful religious symbol, and it serves as an appropriate motif for washing or ritual purification. Joseph Smith stated that water was an eternal element, while Brigham Young taught that baptism was literally a universally recognized act by saying, "Although we have no immediate concern in inquiring into the organization of other earths, yet I will say that water has been the means of purification in every world that has been organized out of the immensity of matter." Water was an important element to many of the ancient cosmologies, most notably the Mesopotamian creation epic, where the hero Marduk is depicted as slaying the sea monster Tiamat and dividing her body, stretching half above the earth to become the sky. Now, a parallel may be found here with the Egyptian earth and sky deities, Geb and Nut, who were separated from each other by their father Shu, who lifted Nut above to create the sky. Geb is often depicted in green as a symbol of the vegetation of the earth, whereas Shu is often in blue and is covered with stars, or excuse me, Nut. Although Nut is also known as the mother of the sun, and she may be depicted as a cow. Now, if you look in the second facsimile of the Book of Abraham, figure 5, the figure for sun is a cow. Now, Shu represents the mystery of space, which cannot be empty since life passes through it. Shu is the great go-between, the mediator of life. He is the light-filled and light-conveying space between heaven and earth. Thales' successor was Anaximander. Anaximander dismissed the idea of a particular physical substance being the cause of all creation, but equated this property with a principle which he called, for want of a better translation, the infinite. Aristotle reported that Anaximander described the infinite as divine, for it is immortal and indestructible. It was said to surround all things and steer all, and was the property from which the heavens and the worlds were created. Anaximander proposed an ingenious explanation for the heavenly bodies. He explained that a sphere of flame originally surrounded the earth and then was broken off into circles of fire. The sun, moon, and stars appeared as openings in these star rings. They were literally the windows of heaven. Now, this is a very attractive thought and was adopted into the Jewish cosmologies. In the Book of Enoch, we have the patriarch taken up, and he sees these windows above the heavens where the sun and the moon and the stars make their entrances and exits. It was also believed that there were vast treasuries of snow and hail, and that when these opened up, they opened their stores to fall to the earth. Anaximander's disciple and successor was Anaximenes, who taught that it was air that was divine, measureless, infinite, and the cause of all things. The earth, sun, and moon were said to ride upon the air, and the motions of the heavenly bodies was caused by a cosmic wind from the air that surrounded the world. Anaximenes perceived a relationship between the soul, breath, wind, and air. He stated, "As our soul, being air, holds us together and controls us, so does wind or breath and air enclose the whole world." The equation of wind and breath and soul served neatly for Christianity's understandings of the Holy Spirit. When speaking of the Spirit's capriciousness, the Savior said, "The wind bloweth where it listeth." And the early Christian bishop and author Theophilus taught, "If I call God's Spirit, I speak of his breath, and the air that we breathe is God's breath." Recall that, according to Latter-day Saint thought, the earth is a living being with a spirit. The earth was said to have spoken to Enoch, lamenting the evil that she bore, while Heber C. Kimball taught that the earth has a spirit as much as anybody has a spirit, and that the earth was born from its parent earth. But it was Brigham Young who taught the most resounding echo of Anaximenes, stating that the earth is a living creature and breathes as much as you and I do. And it was the breath of the earth, and not the pull of the moon, which caused the tides. It was Anaxagoras who taught that the organizing principle of all existence was mind, for it is the finest of all things and the purest. It has all knowledge about everything and the greatest power, and mind controls all things, both the greater and the smaller, that have life. This teaching was to have a significant effect on the thought of Socrates, And in the writings of his student Plato, mention is made of a world soul which directs and sustains the cosmos, much like the principle of mind does for Anaxagoras. But Paul also spoke of having the mind of Christ. And this phrase was adopted by the lectures on faith to describe the Holy Spirit as a sort of divine intelligence shared by both the Father and the Son. Although Latter-day Saints later abandoned this concept in favor of a strictly polytheistic interpretation of the Trinity. This is why the lectures on faith are no longer bound with the Doctrine and Covenants and have not been since 1931. But the personality who was to make one of the most lasting imprints on Western thinking was Heraclitus, known by his contemporaries as the Riddler and the Obscurer. He is known for coining such sayings as, "You cannot step into the same river twice." Heraclitus thought that the essence of all existence was change, yet there remained a design and a pattern and a plan to this change, which he called the Logos. And in obtaining wisdom, one may be said to be listening to the Logos. The substance of the Logos was fire, and it was understood to be eternal. He said, "This world order did none of the gods make, but it is always, and it always was and is and shall be an everlasting fire, kindling in measures and going out in measures." Fire was understood to be divine by the ancients, and our souls and the stars were both understood to be fashioned by out of fire. In the Timaeus, Plato describes how the Creator created souls in equal number with the stars. And prior to the soul's incarnation in this life, the soul was taken to its star with the promise that if it lived well, it would be able to return to its sovereign star and live a happy and congenial life. Now, contemporary astrophysics has eagerly seized upon this metaphor as the natural element of the human soul being the stars. The creation of life requires rigid complex chemicals whose formation requires a very high temperature for a long period of time. Now, the only way you can find this is in the inside of a star. When stars die, the resulting explosions we see as supernovae, and these they disperse these elements through space, and they become incorporated into planets, and ultimately into our cells. We are quite literally children of the stars. Now, this process takes about 10 billion years. Interestingly, such an extensive period of time did not trouble the early saints. In an often quoted passage, which is from a letter from W.W. Phelps to William Smith, he says, "Well now, Brother William, when the house of Israel begin to come into the glorious mysteries of the kingdom and find that Jesus Christ, whose goings forth, as the prophet said, have been of old from eternity, and that eternity, agreeably to the records found in the catacombs of Egypt, has been going on in this system almost 2,555 millions of years." The reference to this being taught from a record recovered from the catacombs of Egypt may reflect the idea that what we have is the Book of Abraham may only be a partial translation of the papyrus that Joseph Smith worked with. He himself stated that the record of Joseph could be found there. Legend has it that there's also a record of the comings and goings of the 10 lost tribes, although you hear that about everything. Many of Heraclitus's ideas were assimilated into Stoicism, a philosophical school which came to hold a tremendous sway in the Roman Empire. Stoicism taught the existence of a world soul of which people hold a portion. Soul permeates the whole cosmos, and we share a part of it and are consequently ensouled ourselves. The evidence of this divine intelligence could be seen in the orderly motions of the cosmos. For Plato, the fact that the planets were able to maintain a steady circular course without deviation appeared ample evidence that they were possessing of intelligence, and consequently souls. And some of the early Christian authors, such as Origen, taught the same thing, that the stars were ensouled, that they were divine and rational beings. Although much less mystically minded, Aristotle commented that the only way men could possibly fail to see the amazing order of creation is that they become too accustomed to it. He said if you were spent all your days in a cave and then one day you stepped up onto the earth and saw all the planets and stars, you'd say, What God made these? That it would just seem so obvious to you at first glance. The argument from design remained a powerful case for proving the existence of God for centuries following. It's found in the Book of Mormon. Alma counters the Antichrist Korihor by declaring that the planets which move in their regular form do witness a supreme creator. And in an early draft of the history of the church, Joseph Smith described in one of the few items penned in his own handwriting the religious sentiments which characterized his early years. He said, "I looked upon the sun, the glorious luminary of the earth, and also the moon rolling in her majesty through the heavens, and also the stars shining in their courses, and the earth upon which I stood. And when I considered upon these things, my heart exclaimed, Well hath the wise man said, It is a fool that saith in his heart, There is no God." But to return to the Stoics, Stoicism expanded upon Heraclitus' doctrine of the Logos as the principle responsible for order in the cosmos, and men were felt to possess a part of this divine nature within themselves. They were said to have the spermaticus logos, which was a seed of the logos. Well, actually, it's sperm of the logos, but it's usually translated seed, or is perhaps better known, the spark of reason. By virtue of their reason, humanity possessed both the agency and the ability to attune their daily affairs and organize their laws and customs so they would be in harmony with the dictates of the eternal law of the Logos. Now, law has always been a fundamental aspect of Mormon theology. God is God because he obeys law. He attained the status of godhood through obedience to eternal principles. Joseph Smith declared in the King Follett Discourse that the saints had got to learn to become gods themselves by obedience to those same principles. Even the gods cannot revoke or violate these laws without destruction to their own selves. The Book of Alma states that if God were to permit mercy to rob justice, God would cease to be God. And it is this thinking that upset editors of the Nauvoo Expositor almost as much as the plurality of wives. One passage from that paper states, "It is contended that there are innumerable gods as much above the God that presides over this universe as he is above us. And if he varies from the law unto which he is subjected, he with all his creatures shall be cast down as was Lucifer." Latter-day Saint thought also came to employ similar language that resembled the Logos when speaking of the light of Christ, also referred to simply as the Spirit, as opposed to the Holy Spirit, as the divine presence which sustains the order of nature and guides our consciences. And a distinction was made between this principle and the actual personage of the Holy Ghost, although this distinction was not always easily understood. Orson Pratt is quoted as saying, "It is a matter of doubt with many, and of uncertainty, I believe, with all, whether there be a personal Holy Spirit or not. The Lord has never given me any revelation upon the subject, and consequently, I cannot fully make up my mind one way or the other." For this statement and others, he was officially censured by Brigham Young with the other members of the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve, and that helped him make up his mind somewhat more, definitely. Meanwhile, Judaism had developed the concept of the presence of God, the Shekinah. Well, the pronunciation is fairly arbitrary. This was the power of God which sustained the children of Israel and could be seen as the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, which preceded them on their journey in the wilderness. The power was often manifested as rays of light. For example, it was said that rays of light shot out from the staves of the Ark of the Covenant, and they blasted away weeds and scorpions and anything else that happened to be in their path. This is from the Talmud. This is long before Raiders of the Lost Ark. I don't know if Mr. Spielberg gets his ideas from the Talmud, or maybe God gets his ideas from Steven Spielberg. In a striking passage of Habakkuk, the prophet describes a vision of the Lord. He says his brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Now, the verse here is from the Revised Standard Version. In the King James Version, the word for rays is somewhat mistranslated as horns, and it was the same misunderstanding that led to many medieval representations of Moses having the prophet with animal-like horns on his head, when in actuality it was beams of light that adorned his countenance when he descended from Sinai after communing with the Lord. At least this is the traditional explanation. Recent articles have said that he was purposely depicted with a horned headdress so that people would know he was the tribal chieftain of the children of Israel. I don't know. The same phenomenon came to be associated with the Savior. Not the horns, but the light. Notably at the Transfiguration, where it is said that the face of the Lord did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. A lesser-known apocryphal tradition states that when the Savior cleansed the temple, the majesty of the Godhead gleamed in his face, and a certain fiery and starry light radiated from his eyes. Elsewhere it is described that rays issued from his eyes, whereby they were terrified. Now, the inspiration for that may be from the Platonic theory of vision. Plato believed that there was a fire within ourselves, which was the soul, and your eyesight was rays coming out of your eyes that from that fire, and they coalesced with the sunlight on whatever object you have to be looking at. At nighttime, when you close your eyes, and you don't have to close your eyes. At nighttime, there's no sun to coalesce with the fire shooting from your own eyes, and so therefore you can't see things at night. And so you close your eyes, and that fire is dispersed through your body and keeps you warm at night. Interesting thought. The same phenomenon is also attributed to Joseph Smith. Mary E. Rollins Leitner, one of his plural wives, noted the incident at one of the early cottage meetings. She said, after praying and singing, Joseph began talking, and suddenly he stopped and seemed almost transfixed. He was looking ahead, and his face outshone the candle which was on the shelf just behind him. I thought I could almost see the cheekbones. He looked as though a searchlight was inside his face and shining through every pore. I could not take my eyes from his face. But all of these occurrences are fairly singular manifestations of God's power. The concept of an all-pervading presence did not find full articulation in Judaism until contact was more fully made with Greek philosophy. And one of the most beautiful examples of this syncretism is a work written about the time of Christ called The Wisdom of Solomon. And here wisdom is described as reaching from one end of the earth to the other. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things. She fills the whole earth and holds all things together. Obviously, much of this language became influential on Christian understandings of the Spirit of God. The cosmography that was established by the ancients remained very well established for centuries to follow. In what became the Aristotelian model of the cosmos, the earth was envisioned as resting in the center of concentric crystalline spheres, which carried the planets in their rotations. For Aristotle, space was a finite entity, not infinite, and past the outermost sphere, there did not exist anything. There was no such thing as outer space. There was just nothing. But on a subtle point of semantics, Stoicism parted with the Aristotelian understanding by declaring an infinite void outside of the cosmos. These philosophies came to influence the thoughts of medieval philosophers, often to the agitation of church authorities. In 1277, Etienne Tempier, the Bishop of Paris, produced a list of 219 deadly heresies which were circulating in the university. On the list was the Stoical notion of a cosmic void. And in 1600, the philosopher Giordano Bruno, who had been heavily influenced by Hermeticism, was burned at the stake for teaching, among other things, infinite space and an infinity of worlds. Although his comments that monks were asses and church teachings were asinine didn't help his case any. LDS theology has traditionally accepted the existence of other worlds. As a footnote to Doctrine and Covenants 8851 in the edition he issued in England in 1879, Orson Pratt stated that each planetary kingdom is visited by its creator in its time and season, although this notation has been omitted in editions issued since 1931. Oliver Cowdery wrote, "It is a pleasing thing to let the mind stretch away and contemplate the vast creations of the Almighty, to view the thousand suns giving light to myriads of globes, all inhabited by intelligent beings, and consider that they are visited with the light of his countenance." Understand that this concept of infinity was understood to be a perpetual, an eternal phenomenon. Parley P. Pratt spoke of the continued exertions of created power by which millions of new worlds will be formed and peopled by King Adam and his descendants. This was a process that we ourselves would participate in the resurrection. Mormon metaphysics has also traditionally embraced the concept of infinite space. Charles W. Penrose once said, "Go even unto Kolob, and there is just as much space beyond as that which you have left." For practical purposes, infinite space was pretty much required to contain Mormon polytheism. To illustrate, in one anti-Mormon booklet, Orson Pratt is quoted as saying, "If we should take a million of worlds like this, excuse me, and number their particles, we should find that there are more gods than there are particles of matter in those worlds. To which the author of this pamphlet adds, "That is a lot of gods." Well, no argument here. But the thought of infinite space is also consistent with the theology that teaches that God creates not out of nothing, but of making use of infinite eternal entities, such as spirit, intelligence, and presumably space and time. But space, even if it is infinite, is not homogeneous. Rather, it is often thought to revolve around a central place. And the Axis Mundi is often a sacred city or temple, which is built after a heavenly pattern. The most sacred spot to Latter-day Saints is the Salt Lake Temple. This is the central point of the church, second only to the city of Zion, where a temple complex of 24 buildings will be constructed prior to the millennium, during the millennium, depending on who you listen to, in Jackson County, Missouri. This is identified by Joseph Smith as the center place and is near unto the land where Adam dwelt. And this is an interesting corollary to those various Jewish and Christian traditions which place the creation of the world, the Garden of Eden, the Temple of Jerusalem, and the site of the crucifixion all at the center of the world. The Axis Mundi is thought to have a counterpart in a cosmic center of the heavens, which is so that that which is built by mortals may share in the divinity of that which is constructed by the gods. The North Star is traditionally perceived to be such a center place. As all the heavens revolve about this point in the sky, it is evidently the center of space and consequently of time, and is thought to be a doorway to the other world. Appropriately, an image of the North Star adorns one facade of the Salt Lake Temple, as this structure is felt to be a place where those on earth may be closest to the heavens. It was often thought that a pillar of light connected these two points on earth and sky, and for the ancients this was often perceived to be the Milky Way. According to one Gnostic cosmology, I believe it was the Mandaeans, the moon was the first stop, and as the moon was full, that was an indication that it was full of souls. And as it emptied and changed to a new moon, that meant that the souls were traveling on their way to the sun. The moon was thought to be an intermediary degree of glory with the sun. According to another account, this is probably Pythagorean, you go out on your way to heaven, I think it's to the Trough of Cancer, but souls that are coming down make their way to the Trough of Capricorn. This is where the Milky Way crosses this area of the zodiac. And as an indication that souls were on their way down, all you have to do is look in a sunbeam, and those motes that we perceive to be dust, those were obviously souls on their way down from heaven. Another tradition, also found among the teachings of the Pythagoreans, taught the existence of a central sacred fire from which the binding energies of nature radiated. This fire was the hearth of the universe, and another band of fire was said to surround the entire cosmos. The sun was perceived to be a glass-like body, which did not shine by its own light, but rather borrowed light from this ethereal fire. Now, a parallel may be found here with the cosmology outlined in the Book of Abraham. Here, a star called Kolob is identified as being near unto God, and the sun is said to borrow its light from Kolob through a mysterious medium known as Ki Venresh. I guess the pronunciation is as good as mine. This is the grand key, or in other words, the governing power. Now, little has been revealed on the nature of this astronomical system. In a curious document known as the Egyptian Alphabet and Grammar, which I was always under the impression was the work of the Book of Abraham, but other writers such as Hugh Nebley have sought to distance the work from Joseph Smith because certainly some of it is bizarre. Kolob is described as the highest degree in government pertaining to heavenly bodies. Elsewhere in the same document, it is written, "Let this be the center for light, and the light of 15 stars centers there, and from there it is drawn by the heavenly bodies according to their portions." This system of 15 stars is also described in the second facsimile of the Book of Abraham. And you can read that for yourself in the Pro Great Prize. Light is the key element to Latter-day Saint cosmology. Orson Pratt is recorded as saying, "Light is the cause and the power by which everything is governed." Given light's purity and its properties of illumination, it seems an obvious choice for illustrating the properties of divinity. In the Genesis cosmogony, light is the first of God's creations, and a very rich folklore built up among the Jewish traditions about light. It is said in the Talmud that the Holy One, blessed be He, cloaked himself in it as a cloak, and the splendor of his majesty shone forth from one end of the world to the other. This was the light of the first day, prior to the creation of the sun, moon, and stars. This light is withheld from men because of their wickedness, but is from time to time granted to the righteous, and by this light they may see from one end of the creation to the other. Now, if you recall, there's a similar statement in the book of Abraham. The Lord places his hands upon Abraham's eyes, and he's able to behold every particle of the Lord's creation. Excuse me. Obviously, the Christian traditions were eager to adapt the motif of light in understandings of the Savior. In the Gospel of Thomas, a Gnostic work, which some people feel is a source for some of the Gospels, Jesus said, "It is I who am the light which is above them all. It is I who am the all. From me did the all come forth, unto me did the all extend. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there." A parallel may be found here with the statement in section 88, 12 and 13, which describes the light which proceedeth forth from the presence of God to fill the immensity of space. This is the light which is in all things, even the power of God who sitteth upon his throne, who is in the bosom of eternity, who is in the midst of all things. This presence, which is everywhere, is perceived to be light. Well, some other arcane references here, but we're getting short of time. Suffice it to say that the presence of God in Latter-day Saint theology is stressed again and again to be the omnipresence is a very common theme in these writings. And wherever there's even injustice or despair or evil, nevertheless, the presence of God is there, and there remain meaning and truth and hope, because there is no such thing as empty space, because there is no space in which there is no kingdom. Thank you.
I didn't build furniture to fit me here. Well, I think Mr. Cameron has done well with his excursion, and it's been quite an excursion, hasn't it, through some Greek teachings and some Islamic teachings and some Jewish teachings and some Latter-day Saint teachings, in calling our attention, at least, to something that we probably don't talk about very often in Latter-day Saint theological discussions and probably ought to talk about a good deal more. In fact, the original title, which Mr. Cameron had, A Study in Latter-day Saint Cosmology, is a paper I would like very much to see written by him or by someone else. I think he's outlined for us the types of things that I would like to see treated and included. When we speak of cosmology, our understanding of the universe as a whole, our basic picture of everything, we've been brought up in a generation where the fundamental picture in our cosmology is empty space, filled with atoms or more fundamental particles buzzing around doing things under certain forces. But that's an oddball picture, if I may say so, in the history of Western thought. We all have a tendency as we grow up with an idea to think, well, that's what everybody, at least all right-thinking people, have always believed. Well, it's just not true. The idea of empty space is an exceptional idea if we look at Western thought, rather than the main line. And what Mr. Cameron has pointed out for us going through this large excursion is what we might call the more mainline cosmology. And he's also pointed out that Latter-day Saint theology is in many ways far more in keeping with this mainline theology than it is with the standard scientific cosmology that we usually talk about. Let me just illustrate in a couple of points that have a long history. One, the notion of empty space full of assorted atoms. Full of is the wrong word, isn't it? Empty space in which are placed atoms which then interact. The fundamental notion of our cosmos, really since the 17th century. This sort of a cosmos, well, as far as I know, was first urged in 5th century BC Athens. There was a bit of a to-do in the 4th century B.C. whether this kind of a totally materialistic philosophy, and it was the most totally materialistic philosophy, I suppose, in human history, whether this was to take over the minds of the youth or whether they were to be saved to a little more respect for some of the more ancient ideas. The ancient atomism taught very clearly all that exists is atoms on the one hand and nothing or void or vacuum or empty space on the other hand. The atoms never change. They're always exactly the same. They have always existed. They always will exist. They don't change size or shape or color or figure. An atom is an atom is an atom forever, exactly the same way. The only change that ever occurs in the whole universe is that atoms get rearranged in space. Now that's the essence of the atomist cosmology. Everything, and that means everything, souls, they're made out of atoms. Gods, they're made out of atoms. Whatever happens in the universe happens because the atoms, purely by chance, get rearranged. Nothing else happens. It doesn't make any sense to pray to God to fix things. He couldn't fix things. God's a bunch of atoms too, and God does what the atoms say do. Just like you and I do what the atoms say do. Don't worry about what happens after you die. Death is your atoms coming apart. When your atoms come apart, they've come apart. And that's the end of you, body and soul. It doesn't make much sense then to go through life worrying about worshiping, paying your tithing, your offerings, offering your sacrifices. Waste of time. The ancient atomists loved to poke fun at religious people for being bound down under the superstitions, not just like Korihor in the Book of Mormon. All that happens are the atoms doing their thing. And they're like our atoms. We're familiar with this kind of a cosmology. You can appreciate why the city fathers in Athens weren't too happy to have the young take up this wonderful point of view. Plato, in the 4th century, as much as any one person single-handedly has arrested a point of view, I think Plato deserves credit for arresting this point of view. After Plato, the atomist viewpoint is a very weak minority voice throughout the rest of Greek thought, following Roman thought, following Christian thought. The other point of view prevailed. Instead of empty space, a space that's full. And we saw various examples of what it's full of. Full of gods, full of air, full of the logos. Some kind of a power holding it together and making a cosmos out of it. Strictly speaking, the atomists don't even have a cosmology. They have many heavens and earths with nothing connecting them all, literally nothing. A cosmos somehow is a connected whole. Material connection in some cases, much more frequently a spiritual kind of something that connects the cosmos, is what makes it a single entity. This is the old viewpoint. Before Plato's time, this was certainly Plato's viewpoint, who spoke of a soul of the world, very literally. It's the point of view that ancient Christianity adopted. Very Platonistic in many ways. After the great century of Plato and Aristotle, the two main schools of Greek philosophy were the Stoics and the Epicureans. The Stoics, with their logos, in many ways akin to Plato. The Epicureans hang on to the old atomist point of view. This weak minority voice that at least lasted in the manuscripts down through the succeeding centuries. But effectively, the fight was fought in the Platonic viewpoint one. The universe is not empty, but it's full of some kind of a spiritual force uniting all things, governing all things. Another aspect of the same argument is the universe totally at the mercy of matter. Matter does what matter can't help doing, and that's what happens, the atomist viewpoint. Or is the universe ultimately controlled by mind? Plato's viewpoint and the standard viewpoint, the one, of course, that the Christians also accepted and adopted. Now, down through the succeeding centuries, Christianity absorbed much of Platonism. These viewpoints certainly prevailed in Christian circles. Beginning in the 17th century, there was almost a replay of the same kind of an argument. Ancient atomism had a sudden resurrection. A school of thought centered around Paris, Father Marin Mersenne, I suppose, was the nucleus. Best known representative of this school of thought is René Descartes, a point of view of materialism, or mechanism, as they like to call it in the 17th century. The universe is to be looked at as a great machine. Now, of course, the difference in a machine and a human being, or an animal for that matter, is that the animal has a mind and is run by intelligence, whereas the machine doesn't have a mind and does what it can't help doing. The old atomist idea again. Is the universe fundamentally a machine to be explained and understood and maybe even controlled then by human beings? This is the ideal of this mechanical philosophy, the Cartesian viewpoint. Knowledge is power. If we can learn how the machine works, we can run it, control it. Now, it's this viewpoint that has formed the foundation of our modern science. The old fight was fought once again, only the other side won. Not really yet in the 17th century, but in the 18th century. In the 17th century, it's rather interesting to look at Isaac Newton, the great father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and everything else of modern science. Newton doesn't believe in empty space. Newton believes in space empty of matter. But he asks a whole series of questions, rhetorical questions. What is there in space devoid of matter? Whence is it that all things appear this way and act this way? Why is it that gravity works? And he has his own answer. For Newton, very literally, space is full of God. Not gods like Thales, but the Christian God. He loved to quote Paul's sermon to the Athenians, where Paul in turn was quoting other Greek poets, that in him, in God, we live and move and have our being. Newton took that very literally. Newton believed passionately that the Cartesians were way off base, that the universe could not be run just as a machine. A machine would run down. The universe as we find it surely has mechanical properties. He gave us the mathematics for the machinery of the universe. But if that were all there were to the universe, Newton argued, it would have run down long since. Besides this, there are also active principles, a good Platonic notion, which keep it wound up, as it were. And it's these active principles which make the forces that operate the universe, like gravity. Newton asked the question, if we're to understand gravity, we need to answer, what is it that's everywhere present, because gravity works everywhere, that knows where every piece of matter is simultaneously, because gravity depends on every piece of matter in the universe, that has the wisdom to correlate all that and make it follow a strict mathematical law, and then has the power to see that the law is carried out? That's a good question. What is it that's everywhere present in space, that knows where everything else is simultaneously, that has the power to command everything simultaneously in space? And Newton's answer, like the good Christian that he was, is God. Newton, I think, could have read section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants, and if you signed his name to every passage we find there. This is not the Cartesian viewpoint. The 18th century saw this argument hammered out. What do we do with Newton's universe? Nobody argues his mathematics works and explains the machinery. But is it a universe that's run by God, everywhere present, acting intelligently to make gravity work? Or do we go back to the Cartesian ideal, it's a great machine, and somehow, don't ask it how, but things can act where they aren't mechanically. The sun across 100 million miles of empty space can still, in a mechanical way, drag the earth around. Don't ask how, we don't understand, but still mechanically. So that's the issue. D'Alembert, I suppose, is the main spokesman for this, if you're interested in 18th century French cosmological development, on the one side with Maupertuis on the other. Maupertuis takes Newton's position, D'Alembert takes Descartes' position, D'Alembert won, hands down. The Frenchman wrote the Newtonian textbooks for the next century. And Newton's point of view was so far lost that when in the 19th century some of Newton's old manuscripts were looked at again, the scientific community who looked at them, absolutely aghast and excused poor old Isaac Newton. You know, he had a mental breakdown, and it must have been after that he wrote this strange stuff about God running the universe. By the 19th century, the viewpoint you and I have been brought up with had so prevailed. So, a brief period in Athens and a brief period, really, in history since the 17th century, we've looked at that kind of a cosmology where the universe is a great machine run by mechanical principles, not intelligence, where it's mainly empty space with atoms flitting around in it doing their thing, which they can't help and don't know about anyway. This is the exceptional viewpoint. The mainstream viewpoint in Jewish thought, in Muslim thought, in Greek thought, in most of Christian thought, in even some modern thought once again, has been a universe that's full and a universe that's run basically by intelligence rather than by sheer matter. When we then read in the Doctrine and Covenants statements such as section 88, section 93, where it speaks of the light of Christ, which is in all things and through all things and round about all things, so much for empty space, which is the law by which all things are governed. So much for mechanical operation without intelligence. Or we can read in section 93, all truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself. See, the atomist universe would just leave out a couple of phrases. All truth is independent to act for itself, period. In that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself. God has given law to all things by which they move. I read my physics book and I read about how the sun goes around through the stars and the planets go around the sun and say, isn't gravity wonderful? I read the Doctrine and Covenants and say, any who has seen any or the least of these, same planets moving under the same gravity, any has seen any or the least of these has seen God moving in his majesty and in his power. It's a different universe. Is the universe full of God, and when we look at it, we see God at work? Or is the universe a vast machine like our science and our science fiction? The cosmologies are very different. Latter-day Saint cosmology has a very real and vested interest in the one viewpoint, and I would dearly love to see Mr. Cameron or someone else develop a real study in Latter-day Saint cosmology, putting it in some of this historical context. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for which you can ask questions. You can direct them either at Dave or at Professor Nielsen. So do we have any questions?
That spirit is matter, then it interacts with ourselves and with everything else in the universe.
Is it that means by which he governs?
Well, I don't think there's any disagreement, at least canonically, with the concept that God controls all things by his spirit. And also, if we accept the same book as you say, that spirit is matter, Orson Pratt spilled gallons of ink on this concept. Perhaps one of his most noted pamphlets was Absurdities of Immaterialism, because it was a very contemporary issue for him, that the spirit was an actual substance. Since then, that flowing of gallons of ink has slowed to a trickle. I didn't get into it myself, as you noticed. Maybe that needs to be explored in more detail. I don't know. So I would like to see a definition of spirit. To say spirit is matter doesn't help me understand what spirit is any better. And that's an entity I would like to have more understanding of, either through some statement or some text. I don't know. That's a darn good question. I don't know why we call this question and answer.
I'll complete the confusion by saying what I'd like an answer to is, what is matter? That's not a trivial question, really. If we take Descartes' definition, matter is anything which occupies space in our terminology. He wouldn't put it that way. He didn't believe in space. But matter is anything which has extension. If we take that definition, clearly, spirit is defined as matter because it fills the immensity of space. Something which fills space, then, by a Cartesian definition, is material. Now, of course, Newton wouldn't buy Descartes' definition of matter. For Newton, the fundamental property of matter, as far as I can tell, is its impenetrability. Now, if we take that as a definition of matter, impenetrable, I'm not sure that spirit is impenetrable. I think most people's theories of spirit make them fairly go through walls. They fill your body and yet don't get in the way of the body itself. If we simply ask the question in terms of modern science, it's a complete mare's nest. Ask a physicist today what is matter, and he'll pass the buck rather than even try to get into it. Is light matter? Well, light consists of particles. That makes it material, I guess. But each of those particles has a wave associated with it, and the light isn't really located at any particular point in space until you look for it. For that matter, so is an electron, so is an atom, following those same circumstances. What is matter is a very complicated question today that physicists prefer not even to ask. So, until we can define our terms as spirit matter, I won't have the definition of matter. I would agree that the Doctrine and Covenants is pretty clear that there is a something that fills space, which is the law by which all things are governed. I'm quoting. So I think I'm on safe grounds there on the Doctrine and Covenants. Maybe that's enough on that one.
Would either of you gentlemen care to add to those comments?
I cheated when I said that since the 17th century we believed in empty space and atoms. we have as a culture cheated on that in a sense. You brought up light. From the 19th century on, as long as you say light is waves, empty space doesn't wave. It might do some things, but one thing it doesn't do is wave. So you've got to fill up something anywhere light goes, and that's everywhere. Since the 19th century, physics has created, first of all, a very material ether, matter in the old-fashioned definitions, if we don't squeeze them too hard. Later on, Maxwell was able to postulate what he thought was the mathematics of the ether, using the terminology of the electric and magnetic fields, or the electromagnetic field, to lump it all together. What's the nature of the electromagnetic field? Physicists were able to discard the ether altogether as long as you keep the field. Now, a field can exist everywhere. A field can be at one point and a material object be there at the same time. A field really is kind of a denatured spirit. It's a spirit with all the intelligence streaked out. It's everywhere present. It can pass through things and be in all things. You can have simultaneous fields there, an electric field, a magnetic field, a gravitational field at the same spot. Now, in the 20th century, we're trying to find a unified field theory that will include not only gravitational and electrical magnetic forces, but also the forces that hold the very nuclei together. A grand unified theory of all fields, where matter itself is defined as simply a singularity in the field, whatever that means. Space really hasn't been empty in physics, in spite of the mindset, and the physicists have the same mindset. They speak of empty space, but empty space is pretty active stuff in the 20th century. It's the activities in empty space that, for example, blow out black holes, according to some very brilliant modern work by Stephen Hawking. It's the simultaneous creation and reabsorption of fundamental particles throughout all of empty space. The universe may be a quirk in the vacuum, according to some of the modern cosmological theories. See, to separate matter from spirit or from field or from whatever term you want, the whole goal of the 20th century in physics right now is to combine all these things into a single entity, call it what you will. Call it a mathematical equation until you get through with it. I think that has some very real bearing on things, too, of which light is one aspect, gravity is another aspect, matter is another aspect. I suppose we could find room for different kinds of spirit in that aspect as well.
I think that's an excellent thought on the idea of a medium for light. In the second facsimile, we're told that the medium for this governing power is Ki'i Venrash, or however you want to pronounce it. I don't know what that is. You go to the Egyptian alphabet and grammar, and it's either a pile of nonsense if you listen to Professor Nibbler, or some people are convinced it's the working manuscript from the Book of Abraham. It's identified as star and then power. Stars crossed out and then powers put in, then powers crossed out and stars put in. And yeah, I'm not aware of any revealed statement on what the medium of light is other than Ki'i Venrash, and we've never been told what that is. There's a fascinating book called Soul of the Night by he's not a physicist, he's an astronomer at Boston University. And it's very easy but interesting reading. He talks about how originally we thought that outer space was simply just a few scattered carbon atoms and then most of it was a vacuum. He said recently astrophysicists have discovered there's 85% more matter than they originally conceived. Nobody has any idea what this stuff is, and it's probably the best stuff. And whether it's Ki'i Venrash or whatever, I don't know.
Okay, one more question, sir.
Returning to the earlier question, what is the ultimate refinement of all this? Is it intelligence? No.
Well, I wouldn't want that. Intelligence, we're told, is eternal. And there's this cryptic reference to in the Book of Abraham, which we've always interpreted to be like the basic building blocks of the Latter-day Saint cosmos. I didn't make any mention of intelligences because I don't know what the heck they are. I don't know. Professor Nielsen.
The last question, I get the last word then. One of his major points for his forthcoming dissertation, I would say in one word, the crucial difference in Latter-day Saint cosmology and that which is commonly accepted is that for Latter-day Saints, intelligence is fundamentally, basically, eternally, everlastingly, just as real as whatever passes under the name of matter, and that's a very real beginning point for the real difference.
Thank you. Let's have another round of applause for our participants today.